verbal communication is a great responsibility. It is a responsibility both for the speaker and the listener. For speaking, for verbal communication, we have to use some language, whether it is English or French or Hindi or Sanskrit. And the languages are a creation of a culture. They are conditioned by the culture of a people. They are conditioned by the social, the economic, the political context of the people. So the words have a number of associations. A word has a religious association. It can have an economic or political association, ethical or moral association. So words are heavily loaded with associations, and those associations stimulate feelings, sentiments, likes and dislikes, even before the word is listened to carefully and understood. Before the meaning of the word reaches the brain, the association of the word stimulates the chemical reaction. And those reactions are quicker than the intellectual grasp or acquisition of a thought, of an idea. So between the speaker and the listeners, there is always this upsurge of reactions. So communication gets many a time obstructed. On the other hand, if the speaker has an ambition to convince the listeners, the ambition to convert them to some point of view, to some approach of life, to some way of living, then the very ambition to convince and convert pollutes the word that is spoken. Before the word can reach the listener, it is polluted. The very process of communication gets contaminated. So I hope we understand that we undertake a responsibility when we communicate on the verbal level. Today, it may be that I am speaking, but when we shall have a discussion meeting, when there will be questions, answers, observations, commentaries, it will be you, the listeners, who will take the initiative and who will speak. So let us be very careful when we deal with the word, when we deal with verbal communication. The 7 days that we are going to be here, I would love to share what I have understood of life, what I have lived. it will be conveying the understanding and the living, nothing more. Not as a teacher, not as a preacher, but as a friend, communicating in a friendly way. If I am not a teacher and not a preacher, why do I communicate? Because since the age of 5, I have been haunted by the immediate presence of the Divine. The feeling of the presence, the immediate, intimate presence of an invisible, of the invisible life, has been very strong. It did not come through books. I don't know how it came. But one felt the visible to be the shadow of the invisible, invisible. The speech to be the shadow of the silence. The sound to be the shadow of the vast skies, of the vast emptiness. That which is beyond the mind, beyond the thought, that which is beyond time and space, something tremendous, immense, which has created the world, has been felt as a constant companion. So when one finds that people are interested in discovering the meaning of life, are interested in going beyond the frontiers of time and space, one likes to communicate. So these communications have no other purpose than the joy of sharing. Few days ago I was traveling in Norway towards the North Cape. The sublime beauty of the Arctic Circle that is beyond words has been perceived and received. Now if I talk to you about that, it's only because one has gone there that one comes back and shares it with the fellow human beings. In the same way, if one finds that the frontiers of brain and mind, time and space can be transcended, that there is a life beyond mind, beyond brain, a life beyond consciousness itself, then one likes to share it with people, that one need not be sad, depressed, disappointed, frustrated. If the brain has not given the solutions of the human problem, there is still one more dimension which could be explored. So this is a friendly sharing for those who are interested in exploring new dimensions of life, new ways of living. And I do hope all of you will listen to the talks or the communications in that simple way, not expecting any authoritative announcements or declarations about the unknown. You know, making any claims about the unknown. Spiritual and religious matters have been looked upon as something so mysterious, so mystical, that when you try to communicate it in simple terms, simple words, the listeners feel that something is missing, the sensation, the stimulation of feelings, awe, fear, stimulation of ambition to acquire something, to arrive at some point, to obtain something. And yet, my friends, reality is not something to be acquired and obtained. It is to be understood. Love is not something to be experienced, but a dimension into which you plunge and live. So, in religion and spirituality, the language of acquiring, obtaining, arriving, achieving, experiencing is irrelevant. There is everything to understand, to observe as it is, to understand it as it is, and to understand one's relationship with what is. So religion and spirituality are matters of first intellectual investigation, and where the investigation culminates, then observation through intelligence, and where the observation and the observer melt away or drop away, then being in the vast eloquent silence of life. So we shall begin at the very beginning. It seems to me that life is an infinitely complex phenomenon. Not complicated, but complex. There are an innumerable variety of things and beings existing and living in the phenomenon called life. They have their own existence, and they have their relationship with the other beings that are existing. To be is to exist and to be related. There are two aspects of life. To be in your factual reality, and to be in relationship with others. And these interrelated parts, these interrelated beings, are organically related to a universal life, a cosmic life. If a person wants to live, he cannot ignore the stones, the mountains, the rivers, the lakes, the oceans. He cannot say that I am not related to the lakes, the rivers, the mountains, the valleys. He cannot say he is not related to trees, to plants, to herbs, to flowers. He cannot ignore the existence of birds, of animals. They are all indivisible parts, organic parts of my life, and I am an organic part of their life. To live is to be in relationship with everything that lives and moves around you. So there is the mineral world, and the plant world, and the animal world, the human world, the world of the planets, the solar systems, the stars, the suns, the moons. Not that it is necessary to study astronomy and astrology and biology and zoology and whatnot. That's not my meaning. To be aware that man is related to all these. He is an indivisible part of all these. He is not a master to conquer the nature, the animals, the birds, and to use them exclusively for his selfish ambition, individual or collective. He is a part of the nature. To be aware that we are parts of the universal life, organically related to the whole universe, is laying the right foundation of a religious inquiry. A person who hasn't got the sensitivity to feel this relationship with earth, with water, with fire, with the skies, with the birds, with the animals, the trees, one who doesn't feel this relationship will have to educate his sense organs to be sensitive to the presence of all these. That is one world, a world not created by man, but into which he is born. It is given unto him, this vast, complex relationship. You cannot ignore it, you cannot dodge it, you cannot simplify it. It is as it is. To understand the complexity of nature is to be simple. There is no other way to simplicity but through understanding. That's why a man may live in a highly industrialized country, technologically advanced, rich country if you like, surrounded by gadgets and means of sensual pleasure, of psychological pleasure, like radio, like television, tape recorders and record players and whatnot. He may be surrounded by all this, and yet he may be unhappy, may be sad, may be imbalanced. So one has to be aware that one is organically related to total life. And if this awareness is not there, if any aspect of our universal life is neglected, distorted, ignored, there can be no peace in man's life. There can be no sanity and equipoise in his life, because some aspect of his inner life gets damaged the moment he loses sensitivity to the outer life. Imagine a person living in big city like London or New York or Bombay or Tokyo, always in some huge building, and the children do not have any occasion to feel the earth beneath their feet, to see the green trees, to hear the call of the bird, to feel the touch of the water. If they have no opportunities, they shrink within themselves. Only dry, cold, intellectual argumentation, discussion, acquisition of ideas and clinging to them, and passively subjecting himself to the entertainment that radios or televisions provide. Can you imagine the poverty of such a life? The person goes on shrinking. So to open oneself out to nature and to all the aspects of life around us, the world into which we are born. We are very deeply related to that world. Not only the man-made world, we will come to the man-made world. Man has to live in the world into which he is born. And secondly, another world that man has created, world within world. But if you give too much importance and lay too much emphasis on the man-made societies, the countries, the nations, their quarrels, their fights, their wars, their violences, their greeds, their prejudices, their conditionings that they transmit into their children. If we pay too much attention to that and lay too much emphasis on the man-made society and ignore the organic deep relationship with the other world, the vast, immense world around us, then also there is no possibility of man finding an inner peace or equipoise. So do I feel interested? Do I feel a kind of joy when I look at a bird? Do I feel a kinship or a relationship with the stream, with the river, with the lake? How do I look at the lakes, the rivers, the mountains? How do I look at them? Do they strike a note of unity? Do they make me feel at home, at ease with them? This is one question that one could inquire within oneself. Whether one has lost the sensitivity to feel all this, or whether one has it. Secondly, we turn to the human relationships. Human relationships are only one part of our vast life. They are not the totality of life. So for living, we have to look at the human relationship, the problems there, the challenges there, the issues involved there. And whether you live in the East or the West, live in India or Sweden or United States of America, it is an open secret that no country and no people, as people, have found out the secret of human relationship. There is no country where human beings are living together in harmony, in love, in friendship. In spite of all our religions, in spite of Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, Islam, Christianity, in spite of our advances in psychology, parapsychology, man has not yet discovered the secret of living with fellow human beings in harmony, harmoniously. Our relationships are a long story of friction, annoyance, irritation, a little pleasure, a little pain. Collectively speaking, our political, our economic, our social life, you know as much as I do, is full of injustices and exploitations and wars and violences. But let us come back to the individual. Individual who is the foundation of society. Who is the reality. The concrete reality. And there you find, you can pick up an individual from Japan, from India, from Pakistan, from Nepal, from the Middle East, from Australia, from Alaska, and you will see that man has not yet found out practically a way of living where he can live harmoniously with other human beings. Relationship throws human beings on the defensive. As soon as you meet another person, you go on the defensive. It is the defense mechanism that becomes more active than the spontaneity, than the affection. You are on your guard, as it were, as if human relationships are a battleground where you have to go and wage a war, or you have to defend against someone who is coming to wage a war against you. Individually and collectively, the human race has learned a lot about the earth, about the planets, about the minerals, about the animals. Look at their sciences, natural sciences, social sciences. Look at the advance in technology and science, in literature, in music, in philosophy, and so on. He has developed, man or the human race has developed the biological aspect, the cerebral aspect, conditioned both, and these conditionings are called culture. When a human race conditions the members of the race in a particular way of behavior, in a particular pattern of behavior, you call that culture, a Hindu culture. They have their organized, standardized ways of behaving physically, of cooking meals, of having their clothes, their etiquettes, politenesses, curtsies, their ways of reacting emotionally, ways of cerebral reactions, and so on. They have one way. The Christians, among them the Catholics, have one way, the Protestants another. The Methodists one way and the Presbyterians another. Among the Buddhists, the Hinayana have one way and the Mahayana another way. Among the Jains, also so many sects. So, human race has been busy conditioning the members thereof physically and psychologically. Conditioning means training, to train them to behave in particular ways. The education, the religion, the literature, all have been geared to the purpose of training the human being. And we have a huge garden over this globe of a variety of patterns. A variety of cultures means a variety of patterns of conditionings. The raw material for these patterns is the same. The sentiments, the emotions, the feelings, the capacity to think, the capacity to remember, the faculty to imagine. All these are the raw material out of which the race has been constructing patterns of behavior. And these patterns, as soon as you meet, you come together, these patterns become active. They begin to move. They have their own momentum. And knowing full well that the person I am meeting has a different pattern of behavior, a different pattern of conditioning, I go on the defensive, that person goes on the defensive, and we meet each other in such a way, with calculations, with motives, with purposes, with manipulation of results and reactions. We go together through this whole game of manipulation, whole game on using the defense mechanism, and we call it a relationship. The human beings have been living this way, and therefore There is not the vitality and passion of real love. There is not the depth of compassion. There is not the pliability and tenderness of humility. And so there is misery, misunderstandings, misinterpretations, suspicion about one another, doubts about one another. Isn't that what happens in family life? Isn't that what happens when we live together, in work together in societies, institutions and organizations? Adjustment, mutual adjustment of defense mechanisms is not a relationship, but that is exactly what we are busy doing. So, man lives in fear of another human being. Maybe the wife, the husband, the parents, the children, the brothers, the neighbors and so on. There are our little wars and little violences, petty little violences every day from morning till night. Something goes against my desire. Something that is disagreeable to me happens. Someone ignores me. Someone insults me. And then I get angry. The anger, the hatred, the jealousy, the greed, the suspicion, and how we behave out of all these. If we watch one day or one week of our life, we will understand why world wars take place. We will understand why there is violence in the world if we watch our own behavior just for one week, with our own body, with other people around us, with our colleagues in the office, with our car, with our shoes, with our clothes and so on, just to watch, without condemning anything. Then we will find out that the roots of war, the roots of violences are within each human psyche. They are within each human heart. And as long as man plays around with his petty little violence in daily life, with his petty little violences in daily life, there is not going to be peace in the world. Whatever the political leaders do and whatever arrangements they make, because you and I are the concrete reality of what we call the human race. The societies, the nations, the countries have a conceptual reality, but you and I have the objective reality. So, to investigate one's life, to find out what one is and how one can live with other human beings and other organic parts of one's own life, is vitally necessary. Investigating a new way of living, a way of harmonious life, is not a self-centered activity. It is not running away from the problems of life, but it is tackling the global problems in oneself. It is tackling not only the global problems, I would say the cosmic problems within oneself, because an individual is a condensed cosmos. He has within himself everything that exists in the cosmos. He has within himself the conditionings of the whole human race operating in his brain. He has within himself the innumerable variety of patterns of behavior, variety of conditions on the biological level. So if he can investigate his own life, on the physical level, the verbal and the mental level, if you can understand what is contained in there and use it properly, he is tackling the global, the universal problem at one end, at his end. So our inquiry has to begin with the awareness that this is not running away from the world and getting self-centered. This is not for achieving, attaining something for the person himself, but you and I, as persons and individuals, are condensed universal life ourselves. I don't know if you have looked at yourself that way. The inner and the outer are only words used by human beings. The individual and the collective are the terms used by the human mind. But life is one indivisible whole. And whatever you do affects that life, the whole life. If you think a thought, you have affected the life flowing through your body, the life flowing through people around you, and the life that exists in the so-called empty space around you. If you think a thought, if you feel a feeling, if you utter a word, you cannot say, oh, I uttered the word, doesn't matter, that thought was a secret one, a private one. I did not utter it. I did not tell it to anyone else. You need not tell it to anyone else. But when that thought is born in your heart, thought is born with a word, and word has a sound, and word has a meaning. That is to say, when you think a thought, you are setting into motion a current of energy. You are dealing with vibration, because a thought cannot be without a word, and a word does not exist without a sound, and sound is energy, primal energy of life. It contains within itself light. So when you think a thought, there is one aspect of what you are doing. You are emanating a word, a sound, a kind of energy emanating from you. And on the other hand, the meaning. So the vibration of that meaning and the wave of that sound energy, these two are emanating from you. Thinking thoughts and having feelings and sentiments is not the luxury you can indulge in, saying that it is nobody's concern what I think, what I do. A physical movement, a mental movement, a verbal movement, they touch the whole life. They affect your nerves, they affect your breath. They affect your digestion. As they affect the surroundings, they affect you very deeply. So an investigation into what one is, what is the nature of movement that is taking place within him, what patterns are moving within him, that investigation is absolutely necessary. A spiritual life is not being swept off one's feet. It is not being swept off one's reason and reasoning capacity. It is not accepting the authority of another person. It is turning the searchlight of intelligence, of investigation, of observation upon oneself. Oneself as a part of universal life. Now, if the investigation is to take place, if the examination is to take place, the observation is to take place, without accepting the authority of another person, don't you think it is necessary that the instrument of investigation, the instrument of perception, has got to be in a, how should I say, in a proper condition. If you have a microscope and it is not arranged properly, if there is something, one little part is loose somewhere, then you cannot perceive through that microscope. If you have a camera and you want to take a photograph, and if you have not arranged the focus, the instrument of perception, the instrument of investigation has got to be alert, sensitive and pure. So those of us who are interested in such self-investigation have to find out what are the instruments of investigation, what are the instruments of perception. And let us begin with the tangible, with the visible, the so-called body. This is the instrument of perception and observation, the sense organs that one has. Whether you perceive through the eyes or the ears, or you perceive through the skin or the nose, this whole human body, the beautiful, complex and rich instrument, this has to be purified and kept in order. If there is disorderliness on the physical level, then I do not think that objective perception or investigation is possible. If the sense organs are slow, if they are sluggish, if they are fed with their diet any time, the quantity, the quality of nutrition for the eye, for the ear, for the skin, for the nose, for the nerves, for the muscles, for the glands, if that is not taken care of, if there is chaos and anarchy on the physical level, and the sense organs are either starved or they are overfed, if there is no beauty and inner order on the physical level, then the senses cannot cooperate. They cannot cooperate, they cannot take in, they cannot receive the impression. If you are looking at a thing, the optical nerves have to receive. From the unit of perception, they have to receive an impression. But if the eyes are not taken care of, then the perception becomes very dim. A part of the unit of the object of perception, you receive only a part. Because the eyes are not educated to look at a thing wholly. To look at it with the wholeness of the being. If you hear something and the ears are not trained to receive in the undertones, the overtones, the whole sound vibration, if you are in a hurry to react before the ears have received. So this reception through the senses as the foundation of your response has to be taken care of. That is where the education begins. You know, spiritual life is really a question of re-educating ourselves at all levels and in all fields of life. It's not an intellectual game. Reading books or listening to talks doesn't transform the life. It may give an intellectual idea of what that life can be. But for living, one has to begin with educating. Otherwise you will understand the truth and you cannot live it, because the senses, the brain, do not cooperate. And when it comes to actual living of the truth, one falters at every step. Then there will be a split personality, intellectual acquisition of the most advanced approach to life. And when it comes to actual living, emotionally, physically, verbally, you go back and lapse into traditional ways, unscientific ways, undesirable ways, ways that lead to conflict and contradiction and so on. So, for investigation, to put the instrument of investigation into order is the first step. That is where the yoga system of education can be helpful. Whether you follow the Tibetan yoga or the Indian Hindu yoga, the Buddhist yoga, the Caucasus yoga, the Egyptian yoga system, you may, or the yoga systems that the Europeans have evolved for European people. But the senses have to be educated, to be supple, to be alert, to be sharp, so that the reception of an impression is accurate and precise. If there is no accuracy and precision in receiving the impression and conducting that impulse through the nerves to the brain, the reaction, even the reaction, will not be accurate. Leave aside the response. The interpretation cannot be accurate because we have not educated ourselves in accuracy and precision, efficiency and orderliness. We go around casually doing things. So to put the whole physical, the whole body into a rhythm. So when to feed it, how to feed it, when to sleep it, how long to sleep it, what kind of clothes one wears, the relationship of clothes and food to the seasons around oneself, the country where one is living, you know, to go into it personally, discover it for oneself. And live that discovery is a great romance. And a religious life is a life of eternal discovery. Every moment you discover a new aspect of truth and your whole being gets flooded with that. So you live the next moment, enriched by that discovery. You meet the next moment and the next challenge. To be religious is to discover the meaning of life and to live it fearlessly. And only in fearlessness can there be humility. So one deals with the physical structure, finds out the way of keeping the body alert, sharp, sensitive. What kind of food one takes, one has to find out for oneself. It depends upon the country, the occupation that one has, the physical idiosyncrasies that one has. You cannot lay down rules and regulations and apply them to all the people. Everyone has to find it out for himself. So the body is eager to cooperate. Whenever the cooperation is necessary, the body, like the most intimate and the best friend, cooperates. And arrives at an inner order, or call it a discipline. It arrives at it itself. You do not have to impose it upon the body. So I do think you will pay attention to this aspect of discovery. This is a religious discovery. To find out what my body needs and when it needs and to have a rhythm and live in that rhythm. When that is taken care of, and if that is taken care of, then one proceeds to the next step of self-education. The next point of self-education. And I think that step of self-education is in relation to the speech. I wonder if you have looked at this capacity to speak, one of the greatest mysteries of life. If you ever have felt concerned about looking at this phenomenon of speaking, how you speak, how the sound travels through you, where the sound is born, how it travels with the help of the breath through the throat, through the mouth, and it explodes, splitting the atom and splitting the sound. These are very great events in life, if one can study how the sound is born. Sound born of friction, and sound not born of friction, sound that is spontaneous, not created by man, but existing as a part of life. In ancient India, this metaphysics of sound was studied thousands of years ago. The sound without friction and the sound born of friction. It has been a great science on which the yogas like mantra yoga or laya yoga have been based. So we have got within ourselves a great mystery of sound. Sound and soundlessness both exist within us. Out of that soundlessness, the sound is born. With the help of sound you speak. So you and I speak, and we have in our consciousness innumerable words, their meanings, their sounds, intonations, accents, everything contained in the psyche. And as it was pointed out a few minutes ago, when you speak, you are affecting yourself and others. First through the sound, and second through the meaning. You are affecting the chemistry of another person's life. One person, or hundred, or thousands of millions. The association of ideas, the meanings stimulate in other persons feelings and sentiments and reactions. So when you speak, you are disturbing or upsetting the chemistry of other people's life. When one realizes the significance of this, that a word can kill a heart, a word can scorch a mind or a heart, a word can hurt and damage something very tender in a human being, which never can get repaired again. If one knows this, if one becomes aware of what the word can do, then one grows into an austerity of speech. An austerity of speech implies for me to speak when it is necessary to speak, not otherwise, not to waste criminally this beautiful capacity, faculty, that the human race has developed through centuries. There's a beauty about speaking. So to speak out, to emanate sound waves where it is necessary. And when one speaks, to be very vigilant, to speak exactly what one implies. Not to exaggerate, not to underrate, not to tell a lie, not to enter into a falsehood. If I have one thing in my heart, another in my mouth, and I do third thing, I am creating gaps at each level for myself. I have one thing in my heart and I speak something else. So there is a gap between my heart and my speech. Nobody is going to bridge the gap except myself. And then I do third thing. So there is another gap between the spoken word and the done action. There may be inconsistency, there may be contradiction. I am just simplifying it by calling it a gap. And life becomes fragmented. You have one thing in the mind, you say something else and do something else. So one has to learn to say what one implies, to be precise in verbalization, and to educate oneself that the action is harmonious to what has been spoken. This is what people call truthfulness. But I don't want to go into the issue of truthfulness and honesty. They have such moral and religious order. One likes to find out words which are simple. Simple and light, not heavily burdened with undertones and overtones. So I do feel it necessary for the purification of speech to educate oneself in precision and accuracy of verbal communication. To say exactly what one implies. To do what one has done, what one has said. But we are such people, you know, if you see a fact, you do not narrate the fact as it has been. You mix your reactions into the narration. Your wishful thinking into it. When you observe a fact, you lose the neutrality in observation, but your subjective reactions get mixed up while you are observing. And your imagination, wishful thinking, motives, all of them clothe the fact. And when you come back with the story of the fact, it is quite different from what actually had happened. Because to be loyal to the fact that has taken place, to have the capacity to verbalize as the fact has taken place, to carry the fact into words as it has been, without distorting, without twisting, needs great strength, great energy. That is why I said we have to educate ourselves in the austerity or purity of speech, so that whatever words are contained in the consciousness are meaningful. And if we throw words recklessly, thoughtlessly, casually, without meaning them, if we play around with words, throwing away jewels and pearls, then our speaking capacity has no power left. They become dead words, empty shells. The meaning in the word comes when you live the word and you communicate. If it's a borrowed word, if it's a word not understood, not digested, not lived, then speaking those words is really like throwing empty shells. They are just dead words. They can't touch the heart of the other person. So I think re-education on the verbal level is as necessary as the re-education on the physical level is. About the other aspect of re-education, we shall see tomorrow. The time that was at our disposal today, we looked at certain fundamental issues. If you remember, it was said that verbal communication is a responsibility for both. The 7 days that we have at our disposal, I will share what I have understood or lived with you very intimately, very frankly, without any expectation of converting or convincing you, for the joy of sharing, for the joy of communicating. We went further and said that life is a complex phenomenon. I have been observing, watching, while the talk was coming out. So, it was said that life is a complex phenomenon. It's very complex. It has so many aspects. Human beings are only one part of that life. And we as human beings, we are related to the human society around us. That is one aspect of our life. And we are related to the vast nature around us. That is another aspect. When there is an imbalance, there is an imbalance between the two, then there is misery. If there is no awareness that we are organically related to the total life, then we shrink within our narrow, petty little ego and the petty little human societies that we have created, and we emphasize only the human relationship and not the other. So to be aware of the world into which we are born, is absolutely necessary to have the sensitivity to feel one's relationship. I wonder how many of us enjoy being with a tree, being with a bird, being with the waters, the streams, the currents, watching the rains, or the sun and sunshine. Not as a means of concentration, nothing of that sort, but to have the sensitivity to live with all this. So that's what we went into, and we went into the other aspect of human relationships, where there is so much misery, so much violence, lack of love. Man is starving for love today. And peace is fragrance of love. Without love there can't be peace. And there is no love. In spite of all our organized religions, collectively we do not know how to live in love, and individually we do not live in the dimension of love. Man hasn't discovered it. That is why this thirst and hunger, especially in the younger generation today, to find out, to explore, what has gone wrong in spite of all these advancements in science, technology, so much money, so much physical comfort? Why is man sad? The young generation is questioning the validity of the whole way of living. This misery, this violence is there because we do not know how to get related with the other person. As soon as we see another person, the defense mechanism comes in. What is the defense mechanism? And why does it become active? The defense mechanism is another name given to the pattern of behavior into which we have been trained. Different races have been conditioning human beings into different ways of behavior, physical, verbal, mental. So the culture, the content of culture is these patterns of conditioning. And they have their own movement. So as soon as we meet one another, those patterns become active. They come to clash, and there we try to adjust them, to make compromises, to make arrangements. So seeing another person throws us on the defensive, and there is no relationship. How can there be harmony? How can there be love? So what do? We begin to investigate. What am I? How does one get related to other human being? We have to find out the content of our relationship today, and is there a possibility of growing into love, into harmony, into friendship at all? Or is man doomed to live in violence, friction? So we have to investigate. And we went further and said, for investigation first, equipping the instrument of investigation. The instrument of investigation, we began with the tangible and the visible, the body. And we proceeded to the speech. Then we will go over to the invisible part of speech. Mind is the invisible part of speech. We will go to the brain, the mind, and how it functions tomorrow, and how does one re-educate the psychological or the cerebral aspect. Thank you. Sorry for having taken some few minutes more. Have you talked about the change?
I think it's best I will do that in the evening.
Oh, you will do it in the evening?
I think 19:30, I can do that.
Fine.
When we meet again.
So.